For 2,000 years now, Jesus of Nazareth, his life and his teaching, his death on a cross and his resurrection from the dead have haunted this world with beauty and goodness and moral power and sacrificial love and the promise of living as a friend of God. And here and there, people have found a way of life that revolves around following this person, Jesus, being with him and learning from him how to actually be changed and become like him. And this has created lives that generally don't become famous or well-known, but become little beacons of faith and generosity and hope, a different kind of life that is powered from a different kind of place. And so this series is about a way, a concrete way of following Jesus that, as a matter of historical, empirical fact, whatever you think about it or him, has delivered millions of people from a kind of enslavement that would otherwise bring them down into hell and death. And this way is sometimes called the 12 steps. It's not legalistic, it's not mechanical, it's not arbitrary spiritual practices that have always been known by the church. It's been used by Alcoholics Anonymous and now lots of other recovery groups. What many people do not know is that these steps were basically learned from a Christian community. It was called the Oxford Group, and they were trying to recapture discipleship to Jesus in the contemporary world. And somehow, beginning with a guy named Bill W. and then Dr. Bob, when alcoholics got into this Oxford group and began to practice this spiritual way of life, they were given power to do what they could never do by their own will and able to live sober lives as a miracle of God. And it struck me, if this way of life, this form of discipleship, these steps and the principles behind them could miraculously bring deliverance, healing, and purpose to a group of hopeless drunks and addicts, might they not also be helpful for normal, high-functioning, emotionally healthy, relationally flawless, verbally disciplined, well-adjusted, never complaining, chronically virtuous, universally admired people like everybody here in this room? In other words, AA got the 12 steps from the church, and now the church needs them back. There's just this huge need for a concrete, non-legalistic, non-mechanical, but actually transformative way of life if you want to follow Jesus. And here, as a gift of grace, when nobody was looking, with a bunch of addicts, for crying out loud, came these spiritual practices. These steps are all just spiritual practices. No surgery, no medication, but people discovered by the hundreds of thousands that if they followed them as a byproduct, oh, by the way, they were able to live sober lives. Now, the starting point, paradoxically, that AA discovered, now all this is deeply from the Bible, is that we don't begin with how strong we are, we actually begin with how weak we are. That I desperately need God. A man named Paul one time described it like this. Now, this sounds an awful lot like something like addiction if you listen to these words, Romans 7. I don't understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. I have the desire to do good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep doing. What a wretched person I am. Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death? Anybody ever experienced anything like that? I'm not going to eat that, but I do. I'm not going to say that, but I say it. I'm not going to go there, but I go there. I'm not going to look at that, but I look at that. This is just the universal human condition. And part of the gift of addiction is it makes our weakness incredibly visible and clear, so I just can't hide from it anymore. As you might know, AA was born in the church. It often would begin by meeting in the basement of the church. Not in a room like this, because this room is too nice, and you all look too good, and you're well-dressed, and you're all together, and you're beautiful. So AA, they meet in the basement on metal folding chairs and drink crummy coffee. And somehow in the midst of all that neediness and brokenness and desperation and weakness, the power of God comes in such an amazing way. They have a saying in AA, rather convicting to people in my line of work. When you go to church, you can go upstairs and listen about miracles, or you can come downstairs and see them. And we want to be like a basement kind of church where they can be seen. Now, you might think, well, I'm not an addict. Those are winos or druggies or skid row people or bingers. I'm normal. A guy named Ian Cron has written a wonderful book about this topic, The 12 Steps for Our Day. And he says, an addiction is just a compulsive attachment to a substance or a behavior or a pattern that is mood altering, makes me feel better for the moment, and persists in spite of negative consequences to self or to others. Why do I do what I don't want to do? And it could be a substance, but you might just think, now, what are you attached to? What's your problem? Step number one is admitted we were powerless over. Could be alcohol. That's the only time alcohol is mentioned in all the 12 steps. They're just spiritual practices. Could be over workaholism or hurry or success or my desire for money or some habit or some behavior or having everybody think that my family is perfect or my image is perfect. And I do things I know. I become what I don't want to be. I think about the kind of dad that I always wanted to be, just joyful and creating magic moments that my kids would always remember. And then there's me as a real dad. Took our kids one time to get a family photo at a place called Kinder Photo back in the day. And it was not a good experience. I went through a series of phases. First was naive optimism. This will be great. This will be fun. That lasted about 30 seconds and nobody smiling. And so then I went to the bribery phase. Kids, if you smile, we'll go to Mrs. Fields and everybody can have a cookie. And that didn't work. And so I moved to the threatening phase. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. That's a good way to get kids to smile. And nothing else was working. So I finally pulled aside our most distraught child, just losing it. And I said, honey, I'll bet I know what you want right now. I bet you wish you had baby tweezers. Baby tweezers was her favorite doll. She had named the doll herself Baby Tweezers. We don't know why she named it that. She was not a forceps delivery child. She just called the doll Baby Tweezers. And so I said, I bet right now, more than anything, you wish you had baby tweezers. Couldn't even trust herself to talk. Big tears in her eyes. Just stuck her lower lip way out. Well, honey, if you ever want to see baby tweezers alive again. Why do I do that? I don't want to be that kind of, I have this picture in my head of the kind of dad that I would be, but I want to be in control. Anybody here ever want to be in control of your family and your kids? Make them do what you want them to do? Didn't want to look stupid as a parent and like I'd fail to other people. And I was angry and I was in a hurry for no reason. I'll just get attached to this stuff. And it's strange that sometimes in some churches, and a church ought to be the place where those of us can be the most real and the most raw and the most honest about, I'm just a wreck before, without God, without His help, from one day to the next. I don't care how long I've been around the church. That's just me. I need Him every moment. It ought to be the place where you can be freest to tell the truth about all that kind of stuff, but it often becomes the place where we hide. I want you to look at a clip for a moment. This is a wedding ceremony. It was devised with a place called School of Life, where, you know, often in weddings, they happen in churches and everything looks perfect and sounds perfect and happily ever after. So they devised a wedding ceremony that actually gets real about human brokenness and problem. Take a look at the screen.
Simon, do you admit that you're a failed, broken human being? Not in every way, but in some ways so serious that you will at points be a grave burden to Emily.
Yes. I admit I am failed and broken.
Before coming here today, freely and openly and after careful reflection, you have listed your failings as you recognize them. You've listed them in this book. This is your book of imperfections. Would you now, before me, your partner and your guest, read some of what you have stated in your own words?
I acknowledge that I'm not good at communicating my feelings maturely. I won't say what's bothering me, but instead sulk and expect you to read my mind and get furious at you when you can't. I can be quite self-involved. I tend to assume that if you're upset, it's something about me. I get jealous even over small incidents and become petty and hateful instead of showing that I'm afraid of losing you.
Both partners admit to their multiple faults. Self-righteousness is, after all, the great enemy of love.
Neither of us is fully sane or healthy. We are committed to treating each other as broken people with enormous kindness and imagination when we can manage it.
There is nothing odd about this couple beyond the ordinary oddness that is everyone's lot. They've merely put into words the errors and failings of which we're all continuously guilty.
We are all broken. We have all been idiots and we will be idiots again.
Do you think that'd be a great liturgy for the church? We are all idiots. We are idiots indeed. And I want this to be kind of like an AA meeting or a Sinners Anonymous meeting. So you might remember Marty last week when he was talking about discovering the 12 steps and just the power of people meeting in that way. It started for him when somebody asked him, how are your parents? And he said, fine, and they weren't fine. So just to make it real easy and level the playing field, I want to invite you. You don't have to, but invite you to turn to somebody next to you, say, my name is whatever your name is, and I'm fine, but we just need to spell out what fine actually stands for. So that's what it means. Now turn to the person next to you and say, my name is, and I'm fine. Okay, all right, we can stop there. You don't have to tell them how you are fouled up, just general fine. So the place where it begins is not what people so often think. I'm gonna try harder to be a better person or a better Christian or to fix up my life or to follow Jesus more, hold my tongue or not look at porn or read the Bible more, or pray more. The first step is not to fix anything. It is not to do anything. In fact, it needs precisely not to do that because if I'm trying to run on willpower, I will never get far. The first step is just to say, I can't. I need help. I am up against a power greater than myself, and I will never be able to beat it. The first step is when my ego and my pride get deeply deflated, and I hit absolute bottom, and I'm ready to just give up. That's where it is. That's what Bill W. found. That's what the Apostle Paul found. Why do I do what I don't want to do? That's what Isaiah found. Woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips. I live in the midst of a people of unclean lips. I have seen the living God. And that runs very counter to our culture because our culture will tell you, you can do it. You've got it in you. You are powerful. You got this. You just got to believe in yourself. No, you don't. On my own, I will spend a pitiful existence trying to polish my outer image so that other people cannot see what an egocentric sinner I am on the inside, and I will go to my grave a respectable fraud. On my own. On my own, I am powerless before my sin, my struggle, my brokenness. And that kind of humility and just desperation, desperate need for God, that's actually at the beginning of healing. I can't. I'm broke. And it hurts. And it sounds like the end, but it turns out it's not. That's what people began to discover. That's what way back in the Bible times people began to discover. This leads us to step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I love the little word there is not to sobriety, that too, but to sanity. Our problem is we're crazy. We all want power. How powerful are you? We all like to think of ourselves as strong, and it's humbling to come to grips with the fact that I am not. I don't have much power in me. When I went into high school, I really wanted to look strong, but I was a little over 6 feet tall, and I weighed 120 pounds. And on the muscle front, not a whole lot more ever happened than that. And just got to live with, that's me. My wife one time, years ago, rented a movie and it starred a young, at that time, action hero named Sylvester Stallone, if anybody's ever heard of him. And it was a movie that was set in the mountains, in the snow, a lot of mountain climbing and so. So everybody was climbing and they had on parkas and jackets, except for Sylvester Stallone, who for some odd reason could not keep his shirt on. So scene after scene, you see only him, you know, dangling from a rope with his forearms and biceps and deltoids and pecs just rippling and bulging off the screen. And at one point, my wife, who rented this movie, looked at him and then she looked over at me. And then it's a true story. And then she looked back at him and looked over at me and then she kind of shook her head and she said to me, "You know, I've just never been attracted to well-built men." And I searched for the compliment that I knew was lurking under the surface, but it lurked too deep down inside there because I was never able to find it. Our problem is we lack the power. We were not meant to live by willpower. We were not. And it wrecks our lives. When my ego and my desire are in charge, so I need a way of life, and that's the second step. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves. How great is this power? Paul describes him in Ephesians 3, verse 20. "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work in us, to him be glory in the church and in Jesus Christ forever and ever." It's like Paul is saying, I know, you're going to underestimate this God. The world and your lives, your problems, your circumstances will make you think too little of him. So I just want to make this terribly clear. Our God is able. Now, he is not just a cosmic spectator. He is active. He is involved. He is at work. Not just that. Our God is able to do what we ask. He doesn't always do it for real good reasons, but our God is able to. But Paul says it's like he just can't get there deeply enough. He's bigger than that. He is able to do what we ask or imagine. Not just the stuff that we ask, but the stuff that we could dream about that we didn't even think to ask. But he's bigger than that. He's not able to do most of what we could ask or imagine. He is able to do all that we can ask or imagine. No. Wait, he's bigger than that. He is able to do more than all we could ask or imagine. No. He's bigger than that. He's not just able to do a little bit more. He is able to do immeasurably more. Paul literally makes up a word to describe this. Exceedingly abundant. There is literally nothing that is logically possible and consistent with his character that this God cannot do. And we got to camp out here. Our culture says that the real forces that move reality, that deliver men and women, are political or economic or technological or social forces, human forces. We will not cry out for help to a God that we don't believe is able. And the Bible says he is. He is able to say, "Let there be light," and there is light. He speaks the universe into existence. He could do it with one hand tied behind his back. He is able to calm a storm with just the words, "Peace, be still." He's able to part the sea and his children walk over on dry land. He's able to take an old, infertile couple, Abraham and Sarah, and have them give birth to a child and begin a nation. He's able to take a young boy named David and enable him to defeat a giant named Goliath. He's able to make a drought. He's able to make a flood. He's able to make a rainbow. He's able to give manna every day, to give water from a dry rock, to feed 5,000 people from 5 loaves and 2 fish. And my God, Paul says, will provide your every need. He is able to deliver people from impossible situations. Daniel from a lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from a fiery furnace, Joseph from Pharaoh, David from Saul's anger, Elijah from Jezebel, Paul from prison, Israel from Egypt. But not just that, none of that is dimmed. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. He is able to take a man who's been addicted to alcohol for decades and give him sobriety. I've seen it. He's able to heal the marriage of somebody trapped in sexual addiction, hopeless, this. I've seen it. He's able to take a young man who was abused and suicidal from the age of 9 years old and give him hope and meaning to his life. He is able to forgive sin. He is able to heal shame. He is able to bring wisdom. He is able to provide meaning. He is able to give hope. He's able to take a young pastor named Marty Grubbs and start this church that brings life to folks all over Oklahoma. He is able to raise Jesus from the dead and promise a resurrection to this sorry, dark world. Our God is able. That's our God. And now we got to keep going with the steps, because this is the steps. Came to believe our God is able. You might think, woohoo, now I can get whatever I want. This is good news. My best life now. God is able to give me the job, the relationship, the marriage, the money, the body, the health, the house, the hair that I have always wanted. God is able to fix that person sitting next to me right now. And I know just how they need to be fixed. And they're squirming because God and I are going to do this together. Actually, no. Actually, trying to get whatever I want is not my need. That's my problem. When my ego and my desire, whatever I happen to want around, that's my problem. That's what traps me in slavery. So that's insanity. So now that leads to step three. Each step leads to another step. They are brilliant. You will notice if you read through them, you can Google the 12 steps. They are in the past tense for a real important reason. Admitted we were powerless, came to believe, made the decision to turn our lives and our will, made a fearless. And the reason is that they were practiced first for several years and delivered 100 people from the slavery of addiction. And then they got written down because it actually works. If you go to an AA meeting, lots of you will have been, you will know at the end of that meeting, they'll say the Lord's Prayer or something, and then they all join hands and they look at each other and they say, keep coming back, it works. Or very often, keep coming back, it works if you work it. Now that's from the book of James. They love the book of James in the Oxford group and in AA, and that idea of a faith that works. You tell me that you have faith in your words, but I will show you my faith by my works. And they'd go to meetings and they would say, now look, she's sober today and he's sober today and it works. And they knew it. And oh God, for a church to be able to say with that kind of unforced confidence, keep coming back. It works if you work it. So that leads to the third step. Our God is able. Yay, that's good. But now the third step is a step of the will. First two are in the mind. I admit I'm powerless, and then came to believe a greater power could restore me to sanity. But now the third step is just the give up step, the surrender step. Made a decision to turn our life, our will and our lives over to the care of God as Jesus revealed him. And this surrender is not a vague thing. It's not just something you experience emotion over in the moment. This is where the steps come in. It is a way of life. The way that I live out that surrender is then I go on to the next step and then the next step. And with my whole heart as best I can, as God helps me, together with a fellowship. Now, the thing about the 12 steps, you'll notice when you look at them, they start out with the word we. We admit it. And you never see the word I. We do this together. I get drunk, we get sober. I sin, we experience forgiveness and power together. That's why there's a crossing, see. We made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And I'll tell you something, gang, when you do that, God will meet you there. Yes. And he does this in ways that may not be dramatic or that may. Years ago, I was back in my hometown, Rockford, Illinois, getting a haircut, and I was in graduate school at the time, getting ready to be involved in church ministry. And the guy who was cutting my hair, his name was Jim, asked me a lot of questions about what I was going to do and was very interested. And so I told him about that. And I said, I'm headed back to California, but my folks live here in Rockford and they lead a Bible study. And, And they'd love to talk to you. So when I left, I told my mom, my mom got her hair done at that same studio by Jim's wife, Pam. I said, Mom, you ought to talk to Pam about God because they're really interested. And my mom said, no, they're not. I know Pam. She's been married 5 times. She leads a very non-faith-based life. She would not be interested in God. I'm not going to talk to her about God. I said, Mom, you have to talk to her about God. You don't get to talk to your mom that way very much. So I said, you got to do it. So the next time she went in to get her hair done, she remembered that conversation, and she sat down in the chair, and she didn't want to do it. Just felt like it would be embarrassing, and she'd get rejected. So she said a little prayer, God, I don't want to talk to Pam about you. I will not do it unless you give me a sign. It's a true story. Pam walked over to my mom and said, Kathy, I understand that you and your husband, John, lead a Bible study. Could Jim and I come to it? My mother took that as a sign and started talking with Pam and found out what her journey with God had been like. When Pam was a little girl, one of her parents was Jewish and the other one was Catholic. So the Jewish parent would take her to synagogue each week, and then when she got home, the other parent would make her say a rosary and ask God to forgive her for worshiping in a synagogue. So she wanted nothing to do with God. By the time she was 15 years old, she could drink any guy she knew under the table. By the time she was 21, she had already cycled through a number of marriages, and life was a train wreck, and eventually she made her way into AA. Admitted that we were powerless, our lives had become, yeah. And she began to enter into sobriety, but the higher power thing kind of messed her up because she didn't want to have anything to do with that God. And so, as you know, with the 12 steps, people have lots of latitude because it's just kind of entry-level spiritual life 101. So she decided she would call her higher power Ralph. Not God, not Jesus, just Ralph. And she did that for a while, but it wasn't working real well. And she walked into a meeting one time, and a guy stood up, as folks will, and he was a mess, he'd been throwing up, he was still drunk. He got up and he said, I'm an alcoholic, my name is Ralph. And for her, she said, it was like a knife to the heart, and she started to cry, and she said, that's not my God. So she just started to pray, God, would you introduce yourself to me? And then that led to that conversation that I had with Jim one day in a barbershop, and then that conversation that she had with my mom, and then eventually she and Jim both turned their lives over to Jesus. Interesting thing, they started going to the church, my parents' Bible study in the church that I had grown up in. And at first they thought, I don't know that we belong in the church. Everybody here seems so put together and okay and normal and healthy, and we like it down in the basement. You know, when you're down there, everybody's needy and weak and desperate, and they got big problems, and they talk about them real openly, and upstairs, everybody looks so together. But it's a funny thing. Eventually, Pam and Jim told their story, and when they did that, other people that were upstairs started to come down to the basement. And a woman talked about how she had been drinking for years and hiding it from her husband. And another guy that had been wrestling with suicidal depression. Another guy actually had a child that nobody in the church knew about from a previous relationship. And all that stuff that never got talked about or healed or dealt with when everybody was upstairs, when Jim and Pam told their raw story, God's healing power started coming out. In other words, your mess is your message. With Jesus, your mess is your message. With Paul, I'm a wreck. Who will save me? Thank God, Peter. David, adultery, murder, over and over in the Bible, it doesn't get in the way. Your mess is your message, because that's what says to people, come on in. So that's the invitation for Crossings. I got to stop. I got 2 more minutes, don't I? I'm going to go 2 more minutes. Jesus is kind of a basement person. I don't know why it is. I find this in my own life. When I think I'm going to come in my strength and my giftedness, not much happens. When I meet with people on the basis of weakness and failure and inadequacy, for some reason, we meet at a much deeper place. In the basement is where you will meet God. Your mess is your message. Apart from God, everybody is a mess. Churches are supposed to be filled with messed up people. There's a saying in AA, if you like everyone you meet in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. You need to be around people that you cannot manage, that rub you the wrong way. They're sometimes called EGR, extra grace required people. Extra grace required. And it's a strange thing. I don't know why this is. It's like a law. Every small group in a church has an extra grace required person. You notice that? They just all do. So next time you go to your small group, if you look around and you can't tell who the extra grace required person is, it's you. It's in the basement. When we just meet together on the basis of, I can't. But a greater power, he is able, is broken into this world, and he can restore. And then the other steps become a way to live from one day to the next in his power and his strength. And that's the way of life that we're invited into. And it's just this incredible gift of God's grace in our day. It is broken into our world. It's kind of funny. The Oxford group got named because they would often be involved in campuses, and Oxford University was one of them. And Oxford, you know, that's as elite as you get. That's real high up on the scale. Drunks are as low as you can get on the scale of status. The Oxford groups stopped meeting under that name in the 1930s. That bunch of drunks are still going. My strength is made perfect in weakness. So I want to invite you, if you want to do it, to say the third step prayer. Would you all bow your heads and close your eyes? And I'll say these words. If you want to, you can repeat them after me. There's no pressure. This is just between you and God. If you want to do it out loud, you can. God, I offer myself to you to build with and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of bondage to self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, your way of life. May I do your will always. And now, to end this meeting, if you will, we're just going to join hands together and say this expression to each other. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. Here we go. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. God bless you.